Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabbit.
Good morning. That was Ann, and this is Peter, just in case you can't figure it out, which you probably can. We're in my native land again this week.
Yes, all the good life. We're starting at the waterside inn.
It sure is the good life. I mean,
oh, it's so fabulous, that place.
Three Michelin stars for 24 or 25 years, I think, and a new star in the kitchen the last time we were there, 4 years ago, and we had the opportunity on our visit to go by the Waterside Inn again for a quick lunch and another thoughtful interview with executive chef Alain Roux, who's even more in charge now, I think, than he ever was since Michelle is off traveling the globe. So he's Alain Roux, executive chef, the Waterside Inn in Bray, England.
We're talking once again to our friend Alain Roux at Waterside Inn in Bray, England. And it's been 5 years since we've been here, Alain. That's a long time.
Indeed. Time flies and the stove is still warm, I tell you.
I bet it's hot. I wanted to know what you've done, what's new here. And you told me that you put in this kitchen. You closed for how long?
We closed for over 3.5 months, just about 4 months, and extended closure, because normally we only close for 4 or 5 weeks. But it was something we planned about 5 or 6 years ago. That was mainly to redo totally the kitchen. So it was a huge project, something we've never done like that at home. And we decided to do the work from the floor to the ceiling, and the whole refurbishment happened, and all the layout has changed in the kitchen.
What dictated a different layout?
Well, we've managed to open up the space, because you can imagine the house is just about over 100 years old, and we had an old fireplace, an old chimney right in the middle of the kitchen.
Oh.
So yes, we managed to get rid of that, and that obviously opened the space, and we gained a little space too. And we as well managed to get rid of a couple of pillars, columns. So again, we managed to move the stove away, and actually it's a new brand stove, which is Atanor. And we have all changed our equipment, you know, from our ovens to our boiling stock pots to our brat pans to our fridge counters, all our cauldrons as well are new.
Tell our listeners, what are some of the high-tech things that will move eventually from this kind of an updated restaurant kitchen into their home kitchens? Talk to me about the thing I keep begging for and don't have, induction.
Induction is one of them, definitely. We've moved on with induction because it's, I think, part of the future. And it's obviously, I think, today we have excellent quality induction, very powerful, very precise, and you can adjust your cooking very well. It's a question of, you know, adapting yourself a little bit, and you know, if you after a few days trying, and you get the hook out of it.
I mean, it's so fast that you boil a pan of water on there in how many seconds?
A cup of water will boil in 5 seconds. It's very quick.
And nothing else gets hot, right?
Indeed. That's why, you know, areas like all the hors d'oeuvre, the starters, where we do the warm and hot starters. Obviously, we work our cold starters nearby. It's very good for that because there's less heat generated.
Now, you need special cookware, but it just has to be magnetized. I, working up to this in my home kitchen, I took magnets to my Alclad, and they attached.
That's what we use. We use only the best in our kitchen.
I told you this is made right near where we live, Canada.
Well, you live in a beautiful place.
Yeah. Alclad
is the
best. Copper core too.
Copper core, obviously, is, you know, when you've got it in hand, you know you've got a casserole, you know you've got a pan, and everything cooks beautifully well in there. And the range that works on the induction is really high-tech.
Now, what about ovens? What is the latest thing on ovens?
Ovens, well, we moved on to rational ovens, which are very versatile. And
rational?
Yes, rational ovens.
Is that a brand name?
It's a brand. It's a combi oven, which is you get a dry heat as well as a humidity if you want to 100% humidity if necessary. And you can adjust each shelves in your oven. And you can go up to, well, we've got a 10 griddle shelf oven, as well as 2 6 griddles. We can adjust each shelf to a certain temperature. So that's how precise the oven is.
Now, does this make a difference in how the chefs function? I mean, are they trained for this?
Indeed. I'm still training on those ovens. And even my young cooks, they're actually teaching me how to use that oven because you can add programs into it, which can be helpful. Most of the time, I have to say, for now, we use it manually. But for certain things, we start to use programs into it, and it's much more easier, Mm-hmm. And the beauty, if you want to have like that oven at home, and I hope they will maybe move towards that, is that it's a self-cleaning oven.
Well, oh, no, that's really good news. I wouldn't have anything else but a self-cleaning.
Indeed, no scrubbing.
Now, here's the question. You've revolutionized the equipment in the kitchen. The chef hasn't changed, except that Father Michel is even less in evidence than before. But has anything different happened with the cuisine that's coming out, Alain?
No, I think nothing much. I mean, the famous chefs are still around, and my friend Heston is obviously still at the top of the list, which is good news. And on our side, well, people still seem to enjoy the classical, and they like to come back to us. You know, it's nice to be on that extravaganza side of cooking and taste, you know, different combinations. But they know that to come back to the true and real cooking, that's, you know, part of their background, and they like to go back to their sources.
Do you still have that wonderful woman who teaches the English to all your French chefs?
Surely. Oh, yes, she's still around. She's still around. Yes, indeed.
She's delightful.
She's wonderful.
Just our listeners like to hear descriptions of food and dishes. Can you just rattle through a few things that are currently on your menu?
On our menu, well, we do actually a foie gras terrine, which is prepared with pigeon breast, some pickled sweet and sour pickled cherries, fresh cherries.
Ooh.
And is all lifted up, enhanced with some crushed pepper, some nice black pepper.
Sounds good. What else?
With that, we've got a nice dish as well, which is very popular at the moment, which is a scallop dish that's served with truffle and in corn, you know, spelt, which is cooked as a risotto. What else? We've got a nice medallion of veal. That's a lovely piece of meat, veal. And that's pan-fried, and we serve a fromage de tête, which is actually the head of the cows, which is cooked. And the meat is blended, and it's pressed as a terrine, and that's actually rolled in little breadcrumbs and deep fried, and that's served next to the medallion of veal of the loin, and that's really a nice dish.
How do you explain this? Everybody's mad about pork. All of a sudden, pig is king. Why do you think?
Well, it's, you know, it's.
It's good, I know, but
it is good. It is good. That's life, I guess. You know, things move, and we get into a time in life where something will happen with pigs, and after it will be the chicken, and it used to be with the rabbits.
Yeah, I love rabbit. Yeah,
I mean,
I love rabbit.
We serve beautiful suckling pig at the moment, which we actually have a new toy in our kitchen, which is a roaster, a rotisserie. And we cook on the spit. And that's one of our little dishes we offer, as well as many others. We cook the sucking pig whole on the spit. And that's a lovely dish.
Yeah, we just went to the fancy food show in New York, and the porchetta was the big draw. Everybody was racing after the porchetta.
Oh, yes.
So part of a chef's job, a chef who's restaurateur, is looking into the future. What do you think? What's coming next?
what's coming next?
Yeah, well, I mean, what do you see as a trend about to pop?
Well, the, you know, chef, still a lot of chefs want to move on to the experimental side of things.
That's not waning?
I think it's normal, you know, every chef wants to experiment. Now, how far do you need to go? You have to be sensible, and I think what will always come back as well is the right sourcing of ingredients, and at the end of the day is making sure that you don't ruin the main ingredient. And that you only do the best thing that the chef could do is to bring that ingredient to its best flavor.
Well, Alain, I thank you. I know you're so busy and you weren't quite expecting us. But I love being able to talk to you again. Thank you so much.
Well, it's a pleasure, always. I mean, it's true. We're very fortunate. We're very busy. Today is going to be a busy lunch, and I'm glad I'll be able to cook for you.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted.
Thank
Bye.
You. Bye.
You know, running that interview, it occurs to me, of all the many, many, many dishes that we've had at the Waterside Inn, we have not had a single one that has not been spectacular.
Right. And we're going on to another star chef.
And we never know what he's up to.
Yeah, a chef who came much more out of nowhere than Alain Roux. But we first met Chris Horridge, and we interviewed him twice because we thought he was so much fun at the Bath Priory, where his reign has been replaced by Michael Caine's, as we talked in last week's program. Chris moved on to a wonderful property called Clifton, although it's pronounced Cliveden, and he's doing more.
No, it's actually pronounced Clifton.
Clifton, okay, well.
Because it's on a cliff, who's going to remember that?
But it's spelled Cliveden, and young Chris is just having a wonderful time there. And, of course, before we sampled what he had to provide for us, we had to take a chance to talk about what he's doing these days. So here's Chris Horridge, executive chef, Clifton.
Chef Chris Horridge, you have much to tell us because there's been a lot going on in your life since last we talked. Currently talking to you at Cliveden, which is a whole other story. We're going to interview a manager here to tell us about the history of this great Astor place. I mean, before Astor and after Astor and during Astor. But when we talked to you before, you were at Bath Priory, and then you made this big jump over here, and you've shifted your focus a little bit. So start by telling us, like, what actually happens here at Cliveden in terms of what your responsibilities are, what kinds of food service program you have. And then I want to ask you about your food focus, which I think has shifted a bit.
Okay. I've been here about 6-7 months now. And essentially, I'm the executive head chef. So I'm in charge of all the food operation that goes on here. Party rooms. We've got three. Essentially, we've got three restaurants. We've got Waldo's. We've got the Terrace. And we've also got the Club Room. Waldo's is the fine dining restaurant. The Terrace.
That's what we're going to eat tonight.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. The Terrace restaurant is still fine dining, but it's a little bit more, we're going for a little bit more of a classic type of food in there. So it's still good flavors, but more classically orientated. And then we've got, the Club Room, which is more like a brasserie type idea. You know, you can get a steak and chips in there or a nice pasta dish or whatever, but ideally still with flavor and nice, you know, nicely presented, nicely cooked. And then there's obviously the party rooms, and tomorrow we've got a barbecue for 150 and stuff. So there's all that sort of, there's all that sort of stuff that I'm in charge of as well. So
a barbecue.
So it's
that
good.
Doesn't seem very.
Yeah. Well, it sort of is actually. It does. I mean, it's, that sort of thing is quite popular here with the club. So it's the club members. So they all get together and they'll have a nice barbie, you know, burgers and all the rest of the stuff that you have a burger down in the bottom in the grounds, which is like, fantastic. The grounds to do that with. So yeah, it'd be good.
Could I just jump back a little bit? I mean, you have a rather unusual background and entry into the world of food and chefdom.
Mm. You mean my RAF career or? Yeah. I mean, I was a chef in the Air Force, so I didn't sort of start completely from scratch type thing when I came into Civvy Street, as it were. But I did. I was influenced by a comedian at the time, way back then, called Lenny Henry. He was a black comedian, a very, very funny guy. He did a series called Chef, which is really hilarious. It's about a 2-Michelin-star chef, and it was all ego and shouting and all that sort of stuff, with all the comedy that goes on with it as well. And I sort of saw past that and thought, this is actually great. What he's trying to do there, I can see what he's trying to aim for perfection there. I'd like a bit of that myself without maybe some of the ego, really, and less of the humor. That's what I did. So I sort of set myself a 10-year plan. from there, I was 25 at the time and decided that I'd like to have a Michelin star myself by the time I got to 35. And how was I going to do that? So I put myself in certainly the right restaurant. I worked for or with Raymond Blanc for 5 years. And then I left there as a senior sous chef, went to work at the Bath Priory, got my Michelin star there and some nice awards there as well. And then I turned up here 6 months ago because it was sort of time to move on.
And now you're back to flying too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the hobby type thing, you know. Well, it's sort of a hobby, but it might become a bit more serious when we start flying to and from France.
Because your girlfriend is French.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got French family over there. So, and really near the coast as well. So it's about an hour flight from where we are based here at Clifton. So it's great to just pop in an aircraft and fly across there, which is what I'm looking to do in the future. So I took a lesson this morning.
You've assumed though a lot more, sort of executive duties here at Cliveden, which is an historical property we're going to talk about. You also have had a shift in your interest. When we talked to you, you were very interested in finding natural herbs and dealing with and more experimental things, and you had a microscope in your kitchen.
I still got that.
Oh, you still have that?
Oh, we still do that, yeah. We still do that. It's not good enough to see the bacteria we're using at the moment type of thing, but because it's not a compound microscope. But we still, when I took over the job at the Bath Priory, I was sort of people like Michael Caines, two Michelin star chef from Exeter, Gidley Park down there, and Raymond Blanc from the Manoir and stuff. There was a bit of peer pressure as such, like find your cuisine, find out what you, don't copy us, don't copy anybody else, find you. So the first thing I did was pretty much dispense with my cookery books, just file them away. And pretty much for the full 3 years I was at the Priory, I never referred to any of my books at all. So obviously initially when I started creating my dishes, they were influenced by what I'd seen and done in these other in the famous restaurants that I worked in. But eventually over a period of time I then developed quite clearly my own style.
And how would you tell people what it is?
Through the herbal, started to investigate herbs actually. And when you guys interviewed me, I was at that very early stage of trying to find out a bit more about herbs. I was being in the Air Force for 9 years. I was always in the countryside. There's phenomenally few Air Force bases in the middle of a city. So I was always in the countryside inspired by plants. So I thought, well, I'll go and ask an expert about identification. And what happened was the expert came down. It was a scientist from one of the universities in London. And we were talking, and all the questions that we sort of realized together, all the questions I were asking were all about the nutrition of the herbs and the seeds and the plants rather than actually the identification of them. I wanted to know how they react with digestion. What do they do for you? What's the compound in foxglove that helps with heart conditions, but it's also highly poisonous? Foxglove is like a...
Foxglove,
yeah.
Okay.
So that's what I wanted to know. So one thing led to another, and I then started to investigate nutrition. So even now, I mean, like people still say, oh, you're still going out foraging and stuff like that. And then we do a little bit, but really the emphasis now has gone through that into nutrition, really, and the science of nutrition. And putting dishes together to sort of enhance the availability of the nutrients within the food.
Now, but you're doing, I don't want to call it healthy stuff, but you're really involved with impact of food on the human body.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we got to the stage now where there's enough people interested now where we're putting grant applications in with the Wellcome Trust, actually, which is a huge internationally recognized charity, essentially. Big name in biomedical research globally. And I actually had a meeting with one of the chaps there yesterday about putting the grant application in to essentially prove that diet-enhanced well-being can increase patient recovery rates. Now, what's that got to do with my restaurant? Well, maybe we can talk about that a little bit later, but there is a definite correlation between the two.
Tell us.
Well, some of the stuff that we do in the restaurant actually gets inspired by working with the group that I work with. So there's about four universities on board now, and also vice versa. So I'll bring certain things to the group for the project. So I can't go into too much detail here because we need to go in and do a little bit more and get things peer reviewed. But we've had things analyzed at Reading University, for instance, which had very interesting consequences when it comes to cancer, you know, some of the food that we were dealing with. So I can't elaborate any more than that because this stuff needs to be peer reviewed before we claim anything. We're not claiming anything at all. But it's quite interesting that some of the items that we're using within our dishes are having such a significant effect on something so serious.
Tonight we're going to have something with probiotics in it.
Yeah, well, I'm very interested in probiotics and how they help food digestion and the sort of the enzymic process that goes on down there. So I did a little bit of research in that, and we are essentially we're multiplying our own bacteria in the kitchen downstairs through kefir. Actually, kefir is like it's actually a collection of bacteria. Which is sort of let's say they were first discovered or first known about in the Caucasus, really. And we are using a non-dairy variety. Well, essentially what it means is we're making like a what can be a fizzy drink, really. It ferments. We're getting like a fruit soup, and then we're fermenting it with this kefir. And in there, you've obviously then got this bacteria, which we serve. Originally, we served at the beginning of the meal, but now we put it later on in the meal now as a pre-dessert, more than anything else. So the reason for doing that? Well, I'm just interested in probiotics and how it reacts on the body. And in actual fact, the dish tastes great, so there's no reason why not to do it either, actually.
Yeah, well, you actually just pursue whatever you're interested in, is how you go.
Yeah, pretty much.
But, you know, I don't want to put off our listeners here. Last time we ate your food, it was just, I mean, I didn't focus on any of these health issues. It was just very, very tasty and delicious.
Well, hopefully we can do the same tonight.
I mean, let's come back to that as a priority. I mean, it has to end up tasting good, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the key, to be honest, once you get to a certain stage in your career, and if you're with the type of people that I've worked with before, making something taste good is not really a massive issue anymore. I know how to paint a picture. I've had enough experience to be able to do that. So it's a bit like when I first became a head chef, I was still learning about what sort of flavor combinations that you can get away with, you know, and you try some most bizarre things, you think, Christ, I'll never do that again, you know. and you wait for customer action on certain things. And obviously, as you learn, you develop as a manager as well, and manage yourself as well, which I think is really key, that you don't get too excited about something and think about the science about it, and then so you send it out because you're amazed by the science, but it doesn't really taste of anything, you know. So for me now, I tend to work the other way around now. Flavor is actually one of the last things I work on now, because essentially I'm not going to sort of serve something that doesn't taste good, you know. I'll look at the science behind something, I'll look at presentation, then sometimes I'll paint the picture, as it were, and go, right, I'm going to do it like this. This is how I want to present it. Now, what am I actually going to present? Which is not necessarily the normal way to do things, and probably flies in the face of certain chefs where they say it's all flavor, flavor, flavor. Well, that's, yeah, it is all about flavor, flavor, flavor. But of course, presentation plays a big part, because you don't taste food with your eyes, and that's the first thing that as it comes to the table. So I like to concentrate on presentation, and that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be over the top or in your face or Brit art type thing on a plate. You know, we have a dish downstairs which you'll see tonight, which is inspired by Fernand Poix, a very famous chef from the 1930s, who one of his famous sayings was butter, butter, and more butter, you know. So for me to do that, it's quite ironic. And it's a very simply presented dish, because it's a dish
butter,
that's inspired.
Butter, butter,
and
butter?
No, I don't, actually. And I use less and less of it, even in my what I call my with menu. So we've essentially got two tasting menus. We have a with menu and a without menu, and then there's an a la carte, which is inspired by both those two tasting menus. But the idea is, because we've got three restaurants here, is that when you come to Waldo's, essentially, you're going to have a tasting menu, because you can get three courses elsewhere.
But, I mean,
elsewhere,
is there
There's a with and without. And the with and without menu, we don't really want, not really deliberate pun intended, but we're not trying to ram it down people's throats that it's all healthy and super healthy, and everybody's going to come out, like, you know, super fit when they finish the meal. That's not really what we're trying to claim. We're just trying to look at it and say, look, if we can give you a sort of eight, nine course tasting menu that has no gluten, no dairy, apart from the cheese. We haven't got around to making cheese without dairy yet, but and minimum sugar in there, and it tastes and looks just as good as any other sort of Michelin type standard food that you're going to have out there, then why not do it if we can do that?
Your aim is to not just meet individual dietary needs, but to actually cook and present food that already has built in these things you're talking about.
As standard.
No dairy, no...
As standard. So the idea is, I mean, I'm sure you'll see tonight, the point of it is that you can... Intolerances, I'm sure you're certainly aware in America, the intolerances are massively on the rise. And certainly here in the UK, it's huge.
Yeah, but see,
I don't understand
why so many people have celiac disease.
Oh, there's all sorts of stuff. And there's various studies being done to say people wouldn't eat out if they found they had these conditions and stuff like that. Now, what we're looking to do here is just say, look, okay, well, we can cater to these conditions without even changing our menu. You can essentially have the same as your partner. You can have the same meal as your partner, and you will both enjoy the meal. You can eat the same food, even though there's no gluten, no dairy, no sugar. Now, that pretty much goes against what people expect.
Yeah, but you really think that gluten and sugar... Well, I mean, some sugar, excess sugar, of course, but gluten and lactose, they're all bad?
No, not at all. No, what I'm not saying is, like, you know, we're not trying to take on the Milk Marketing Board or the, you know, the Flour Council, whoever looks after bread flours and stuff. Essentially, what we're trying to accommodate those people who do generally have those conditions. Now, you always get the people out there who, you know, the slight sniff of a cold type thing, and they're straight down the doctors and stuff like that. You know, they're a little bit precious about things like that. But we're essentially looking looking to accommodate seriously those people who do generally have conditions, and they are generally in these conditions out but there. If somebody's lactose intolerant or gluten intolerant, it can have a serious effect on their health.
What you're talking about, I think, is like what I've advocated for a long time, which is in terms of the physical world, universal accessibility, universal design. It doesn't mean that you have to have a disability to have difficulty negotiating some stairs or a certain kind of doorknob or anything. And if you build it to be universally accessible, then it accommodates not just people with disabilities but people with babies and strollers. And
I like that. You're talking about ergonomic food, aren't you?
Yeah.
We started something here, guys.
Yeah, ergonomic food. There's a same thing.
That's right, isn't it? Ergonomic food, something like that, isn't it? Ergonomics has to do with design of things to make things easier, isn't it?
Well, that's what I thought you were saying.
Yeah, I am saying that. That's exactly what I'm saying. But I just thought about you tying it in with doorknobs and stuff makes it quite interesting. Yeah, but
there we go. So we're going to have a probiotic doorknob.
Yeah, exactly.
You see, listeners, you thought Peter wasn't following what was going on here, but he's been watching these rascals. And we just can't wait, Chris, to see what you're going to present for us this evening, because it's always been a wonderful surprise before. So we thank you so much for joining us. And, sweetheart, do you have any more questions, or are we just going to let Chris go? And
no, I'm going to actually recite the menu after we eat it.
Oh, you're going to do that? Okay, well, in that case, that will be coming at the end of this interview by the time it's broadcast. In the meantime, Chef Chris Horridge, congratulations on your new appointment at Waldo's, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us on the menu.
No problems at all. Nice to be back. Thank you.
Bye.
And now, this morning, you probably wondered if we were ever going to take a break, but now we're going to.
Now
it's time.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Remember to keep in touch with us. Talk to us. Email. Follow me on Twitter, Facebook, blog.
Just keep talking. just push the button on our homepage, and you'll get to the method of your choice. And now, well, let's see.
Yeah, let's move to the hotel side. Well, we're going to go to Clifton.
We actually took a break, because we really needed to take a break. But continuity would say that Clifton is next, and a fascinating history of this beautiful property.
Listeners, we're now going to learn a lot and have a good time in the process, because we're talking to Tomas Mendelski, who's the duty manager at, I've been calling it Cliveden, and he says it's called Clifton, and he can tell us why.
Exactly.
Welcome, Tomas.
Yes, welcome. Clifton, because it's located in the Thames Valley area, and as you are on the boat, on the boat and riding on the Thames River, looking up on the hill, you're looking on the cliff. So,
and it
that's
was spelled why. Differently.
And it was spelled differently in the past. It was spelled C-L-I-F-F-D-E-N, and it derives to be Clifton, spelled differently now. But it's over 300 years, you could expect that.
Ah, okay. Tell us, when was this built and by whom? And
well, okay. Clifton's got at least 300 years of history, so I can tell you at least a bit about it. It was built in 1666 by George Villiers, the second Duke of Buckingham.
Oh, Duke of Buckingham.
Oh, yeah, he's a character. He's in the Three Musketeers and all kind. He was quite a villain and quite a romantic gentleman also, I understand.
Definitely, you're quite right here, yes. It was actually built initially as a hunting lodge, if you could imagine.
Oh, they all started like that.
Exactly,
didn't they?
Yes. And coming back to the romantic story, of course, you know, Clifton, lovely house, hunting lodge. It's all connected to Countess of Shrewsbury and Duke of Buckingham. He had an affair with her. And then, of course, Earl of Shrewsbury wasn't very happy with that and called a duel in between them. In just 2 years after Clifton was built, so 1668, that was the date of the duel.
Duel between who?
Between Buckingham
yeah.
and Earl of Shrewsbury, so husband of.
Okay.
So that was quite interesting story, and it actually all happened in London at Putney Bridge.
Really?
It's now sort of central London now.
Now who survived?
Well, they both survived.
Oh, they both survived.
it wasn't that you know,
neither,
someone needed to be killed.
Good shots.
Yes, exactly. They weren't maybe too good soldiers. This was the first interesting story.
And so then what happened to the property?
Then, of course, the property went into another hand of actually Lord George Hamilton, who was later named as Earl of Orkney. And it was actually, he was in possession of the house since 1696 till 1739. And he was the famous soldier in the Marlborough campaign.
Oh, okay.
And he was given as well, as he was so good as a soldier, in serving, to the king, he was given a set of tapestries which are downstairs as you walk in. That three tapestries in the Great Hall.
Right.
Still, till today's date. And then, the little story behind the tapestries is that in 1795, Clifden had a fire. And they went, somehow, no one knows how, they went from here. They disappeared. And I'm going to jump in like 100 years later, but Lord Astor, later, when he actually bought the house, and he went to Paris and bought them back at the auction in there, not even knowing its history. Very strange.
Now, I mean, how did it get from a hunting lodge to this really grand country estate?
Well, there was seven owners altogether, and they were all rebuilding it. They were all decorating it in their styles, in their ages.
The style we see now?
It's more or less from 1850s. And it's designed by Charles Barry, the room we're sitting
major.
Now.
He's the one who designed the Houses of Parliament.
Exactly, the very same architect.
Which were also, incidentally, they replaced a building that was burnt to the ground as well.
Exactly, yes.
Oh, interesting.
Only the wings left. But they of course, rebuild it and redo everything.
Now, this character, Lord Astor, I mean, was he English or was he American? There's an American connection in there somewhere.
Yes, I mean, Lord Astor was an American gentleman.
Who made a lot of money.
Of course. I mean, the history behind his family is he came initially from Germany, I believe. He was a butcher.
A butcher?
Yes. And then he went into state. I believe his family went into estate business. And they made money on that, mainly on that. And that's how Lord Astor, the one who actually bought Clifden in the end in 1893, had his money. I was told that he was in possession of 90% of today's Manhattan in the early 20th century.
I guess he was a property man. Curiously enough, there's a hotel in New York which he had built called the Waldorf.
Waldorf Astoria.
And Astor, of course, for Astoria.
His family middle name is Waldorf.
Exactly.
Right.
But he came out, he was an Anglophile, so he decided to settle in England instead?
Exactly. I mean, he's given, Waldorf had given Clifden to his son, who actually married Nancy Langhorne, that's her maiden name, then became an Astor, and came down here. So he bought Clifden in 1893, and they came down here three years later, so 1896.
But she, Nancy, inherited this from her father?
From his father.
His father.
Yeah, exactly. So it was her father-in-law.
And she raised a family here. She lived here. And it was this grand?
I mean, they settled up the family here, yes. They settled up the British sort of life in here. And then she ended up being the first lady MP in British Parliament.
Yeah. Why did she want to do that?
She was quite a character in her own right.
Definitely, yes. I believe she ended up being an MP in sort of 1920s. So just 20 years later, after she came down to UK, she's already a famous politician.
Oh, amazing.
She must have been quite a character. Now, let's fast forward to the recent when this became a property that you could not only admire and visit as if it was a, as if it was a.
Could I say one thing is while you're doing that is when you're talking about the, how it was left to the National Trust, comment on all the stuff in it. All the contents of the house were also part of this deal. Can you tell us about that? Now, she lived here until, what, 45?
Exactly. She lived here in until 40s, and she actually died in 1966.
Yeah, so she moved, but she donated to the National Trust.
Yes.
And all its contents?
With all the grounds and all the artifacts, all the pictures, everything.
I mean, museum-quality paintings.
Exactly. It all went to the National Trust. She'd given it all to them.
But now the situation is different. Now, thanks to Mr. Von Essen, who subsequently, I guess, acquired the property, you not only can visit here as a tourist and look at it, but you can also stay here.
Absolutely, you can stay here. And it actually became a hotel since 1986 it opened. So it's over 20 years now. As we are a hotel, and we're currently run by actually UK-based group of hotels called Van Essen, with a chairman, actually Lord Andrew Davies. And we currently have, in the UK and France, because we have one property in France called Château de Bagnol, we currently have 30 properties across from the south of UK to the northern parts, even Edinburgh and everything like that is covered.
Yeah, so listeners, you'll remember if you're a steady follower of the program, Sharrow Bay on Ullswater and the Royal Crescent in Bath, both places that we've stayed, the Von Essen Hotels where we've interviewed people there. And there, it's the wonderful experience of feeling like you're a guest.
Absolutely,
in
yes.
somebody's stately home. It's not just a hotel experience, and we are just soaking that up as we sit here in the Barry Room talking to Thomas. I'm not just sure exactly what we're going to do next, but I'm sure it'll be fun. And Thomas, we thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to us.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
And I might just throw in here, I mean, the staff here is so gracious, hospitable, and wonderful. I wouldn't hesitate for the world to recommend it. Thanks.
That's why we call Clifden House Hotel, so we feel as you would be in your house.
Better than in my house.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
Once again,
thanks,
Thomas, thank you so much. Just in case you're wondering, On the Menu does have something of a yen for the stately homes of England. And after Clifden, a couple of days later, we went on to the Manor House in the beautiful village of Castle Coombe.
That is a pretty little place.
In Wiltshire. Yeah.
It's a little overrun with tourists at this point, but it's beautiful.
Yeah, anyway, where we talked to the general manager, and then after the break, we're going to talk to the chef.
Paul Thompson, GM of Manor House Hotel and Golf Club, you've got a huge job.
I think I have a great job, actually. I have a great team, and I have a lovely, fantastic place to work, which, of course, your listeners won't appreciate from home, but it really is a fantastic property to run.
Now, let's just back up and explain, where are we? What is this place?
Sure. Well, the Manor House is located in a village called Castle Coombe, which is on the southern tip of the Cotswolds, situated just 20 minutes from Bath, and on the train from London, it's just an hour and a half to the west of London. Nestled really in a beautiful valley, Castle Coombe has been voted the UK's prettiest village.
Oh, I believe it. It really is, yeah.
It's quite something. It has quite a lot of filming history, actually. Originally filmed in the first version of Dr. Dolittle, which was filmed in the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
More recently, we've had two feature-length films here, one called Stardust and one soon to be released called Wolfman. It really is the most fantastic setting, and quintessentially I think this is England. I really do, and that's why we love
it's
so.
It's what you'd like the English image to be, actually.
It is, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah,
and you wouldn't pick Huddersfield, which Peter, that's where Peter's from. Who was it you were talking to? And you said, they said, where are you from? And you said, Huddersfield. He said, I'm so sorry.
Although I saw on your website, you've got some pretty dramatic pictures of the sunset there, which I thought were very pretty. Oh, was it? Yeah. It looked really, really stunning.
Okay, now tell us, well, we know where we are now, but tell us the history of this wonderful estate, or what do you call it, a country estate?
Yes.
It's on 365 acres, which is huge.
Yes. Well, originally, the Dunstanville family, who originally owned the castle in Castlecombe, there was actually a castle here, which dates back to the Norman times. In the 14th century, the castle started to be a fairly unluxurious place to live, a little bit too windy, etc., etc. So they decided to build a manor house and let the castle go to ruin. And the building that we're in now is part of that 14th century manor house that was constructed.
It was built in 13-something?
Yes, I don't know the exact dates, and it's a little bit sketchy as to which parts of the house are original. And then, of course, over time, bits were added, other bits were knocked down. There was a water mill on this site originally. But in order to build the manor house, they even they diverted the river around the outskirts of the plot of land we're on currently. But allegedly, if you stood on any of the hills that are surrounding the estate and looked 360 degrees, every single plot of land that you could see, they would have owned. And I think that was pretty much the case up until the 1940s, when death taxes started to catch up with them, and then they had to sell the plots of land off.
So you think this was under construction for several centuries, basically?
Exactly, yes, yes.
Well, now, the gardens are as much of interest as the house. The house is stunning. I mean, and the way you've modernized it. I mean, I've stayed in castles, and I've stayed in manor houses where the plumbing didn't work. Really a hardship. This is really luxurious in the sense that it's all the amenities are modernized and carried forth without losing the charm.
I think that's really very, very important. We know, for example, in August we're going to be refurbishing all of our public areas. And that's been a really challenging process for us, because we know the manor house and its heritage. We know what's modern and what's, how they say, funky at the moment. And somehow we have to balance those two ingredients together. But it's a fascinating place to run. It takes an awful lot of maintenance, but it's all I am doing, or indeed anybody who comes through this place, is just preserving something which hopefully will be here for many, many years to come.
How many bedrooms do you have?
We have 48 bedrooms. 21 of those are actually in the house itself. And then the remaining 27 were originally workers' cottages, which are within the estate, which we've converted into junior suites and suites. Six of those have working fireplaces, for example. And they're very charming and very, very, very delightful.
And the people living there feel like they're living in the village.
Yes, although we're still within the estate. So the village gets an awful lot of day trippers, as you can imagine.
Yeah,
so charming. Sure. And we keep them at a diplomatic distance, if I can say that.
Now, we didn't actually touch on when the property actually became a hotel.
Sure.
And who owned it and put it all together?
Sure. It originally became a hotel in 1948 by an ex-army colonel and his wife. And it did sort of okay, I think. They had a specialty for horses, which were on the estate, and also trout fishing. And then it passed to a family called the Cleggs, who had it for around about 20 years. And it's been under its current ownership since 1981. And since that time has really been classified as one of the top 200 hotels in the UK. So it's had a charming, very, very charming history. when it was privately owned, I think had some very interesting characters, from what I understand, running through it.
Oh, yes. Do
you want to
share?
Any little stories you'd like to put in there?
I'm not quite sure that your radio program is that sort of show. But we understand that Mrs. Clegg used to run the place with a rod of iron, so the staff used to be quite fearful of her. And she still pretty much had that reputation right up until they sold it to the current ownership. But they pretty much did a good job of looting the place, from what I understand.
Oh, really?
So many of the garden statues, some of those disappeared, and all sorts of things went on.
So you did a lot to put it back together again.
Yes, and we continue to do a huge amount through various pictures that we have of the times. You know, we've got a guest register from 1962, which is fascinating to see all of the guests who've signed in and been through the place. And we've always enjoyed here a huge amount of loyalty from guests who've stayed here over the years. So we have people who've been coming here for 35 years. The price has changed slightly since then. We require more than a couple of shillings, but not much more, you'll be pleased to know.
Now, Exclusive Hotels is an affiliation?
Yes.
Hotels of sort of like nature.
Yes, we're only a small group. We have five hotels, two golf courses, and a spa. But it's privately owned by an Italian family, and I would say very well run. I've worked for them for 9 years, so I would say it's a very enjoyable company to work for.
Now, you mentioned a spa and the golf club, the golf course.
Sure.
I'm amazed. Sometimes you get stuck in these country states. There's nothing to do. I could mention several right off the top of my head, unless you'd like to just wander around.
Don't be a naughty girl.
I'm not. I won't. But there's plenty.
Oh, go on. Yes.
Plenty to do here. You have the spa.
Well, we don't have a spa here. We have a... we have our 18-hole championship golf course.
And this is highly ranked.
Yeah, it's ranked as one of the top 100 golf courses in the UK. And many of the golfing magazines rate it in the gold category. We're quite proud of it. It really is a great course and receives tremendous feedback. The location of it, the holes, the condition of the course is exceptional and very well kept. So we have a very good reputation for that. But then there are many things to complement just golf, and that's not everybody's cup of tea. So all of the country pursuits, of course, can be done here, like clay pigeon shooting. We have obviously the Castle Coombe racetrack, which is just sat up behind us, and there you can do many motorized activities. Traditional things like clay pigeon, croquet, or we have a putting green outside, and then
tennis.
We have a tennis court, and then 2 years ago we found a brochure from the hotel back in its heyday of the 50s, and they were advertising fishing, and what they had done is they'd lined the Bybrook River with gravel and stocked it with trout. So we've started to do that, and we now have a gillie who works on the river and can take people out fishing during the season, and it has quite a good stock of brown trout in there.
And you have weddings back to back.
we have a good following of weddings, because it's an ideal property in which to get married.
And then I wanted to mention that you have, again, this mix of traditional atmosphere, but all the state-of-the-art technology for conferencing. But you're also going in the direction of green conferencing. Tell us about that.
Well, green everything, really. I mean, it's sort of it's rather akin to going back to World War II, really, in terms of the marvelous things that were done and economies that were driven in those days. It feels like we're trying to go back to recreate some of the good discipline that was applied to running estates like this. So, for example, we've managed to cut our waste down by around about 20% on last year, which is a great achievement for a state like this, and a lot of that's done through reduced packaging and et cetera. We have a huge project in terms of energy saving and becoming more energy efficient, and then right through to the simple things like recycling our food waste for composting. Tom was mentioning earlier about growing vegetables and things on the estate, which contribute in real terms to what we provide. But that's always going to be a balance, because at the end of the day, we're a luxury property, and sometimes that conflicts. And
yeah,
therefore,
which is my next question, is who actually is this designed for? Who comes here?
Sure. Well, we have a range of guests. The majority of our business is leisure, people traveling around the country, American guests, Japanese, UK guests, and then we have some who come here for meetings, some who come here for weddings, a whole mixture of people who all have very different needs that we hope to cater for and deliver on, and that makes it a very interesting property.
Oh, it
to
was
run.
When we had this late lunch in the bar, I mean, I saw there was one of everything in there. It was fun, you know. I love that environment.
Well, let's just give an idea of what's in our room. First of all, we go upstairs to our room, but we go further upstairs to the bathroom.
Yes,
and
yes.
And there's a very thoughtful sign above the tub, which says, mind your head on the beam. And the beam is probably 14th century.
Yes.
But the tub is wired for TV.
Yes.
It has a TV built into the bathtub called an Aqua TV.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So that means we don't get electrocuted.
This is a very startling place. If you push the right buttons, you can actually see to make up or comb your hair in the mirror, but the halogen lights are on separate bulbs. And yes, there is a light in the shower, but you have to remember to turn it on at the bottom of the steps.
And we're having such a good time. But
as we look out the window, everything is a sea of green. Putting green being, of course, watered because it's raining.
Yes. Well, that was very rude of us. We should have organized. If you'd have come yesterday, we had perfect sunshine yesterday.
But this is a place oozes charm, but at the same time, you haven't forgotten every modern convenience. And I think that's a really unique combination.
That's the key. I'm sure you must be, no plumbing.
Yeah, I'm sure you must be very proud of that.
Well, yes. I mean, there's a huge team that sort of delivers that.
Could I ask one more question? Oh,
sure.
How many people does it take to run this place?
Currently 113 of the good and faithful do that. And that almost is, I think, your point about giving up on charm and the plumbing. You know, you can't run a place like this without good people and friendly people, and that's pretty key to what we do here.
Well, is there how about a website?
Yes. Oh, we've got all of the modern fandangles that you'd expect. So our website, which of course is www.manorhouse.co.uk, is there, and you will see some great photography of the estate on there, what we're doing currently in terms of activities on the estate, any special offers that we're promoting at the time, and then just general things like our menus are there for people to have a look at and get a really good feel for the estate and what we do here.
Anything we've missed?
I think we've probably covered
We forgot about getting here if you're in a hurry. So what was the record number of helicopters you had here at one time?
We've had 9 in one go. And they all landed within half an hour of one another. I won't say that the villagers were particularly happy about that. And I don't think I've seen my switchboard light up in quite the same way since. But it was a great, great experience.
But more realistically, you can get here as long as the traffic isn't backed up in about 90 minutes from Heathrow, about two hours from Gatwick, and the train drops you off close by as well, and that's probably an excellent option.
Mm. Yeah, the train works really well, and just an hour and a half direct from.
And let's not forget that some of us who come from other parts of the country are prejudiced and think the Yorkshire Dales is beautiful. Other people talk about the Peak District. Other people talk about the Lake District. But the most picture postcard beautiful part of England, without argument, is the place we're in right now, that part of the south called the Cotswolds. So if you haven't been here, you just have to come. And here's a place to stay where you can explore easily. And now it's time to take another break, but stay with us, because on the other side of the break, we're going to talk to the sous chef who cooked for us at the Manor House later in the evening.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Of course, you're with On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and concluding today's program, it's almost a circular thing, because you'll find out in this interview that the sous chef who cooked for us at the Manor House as we had dinner after the two interviews, why is it around
because
the
he also cooked at Small World at
the Waterside Inn
They bump into each other at all these same places. Yeah, wonderful.
He said essentially, Alain Roux really taught him everything that he really needed to learn about cooking. So here he is.
Despite this endless, endless rain that we're discovering here in the Cotswolds, we are loving being at the Manor House Hotel and Golf Club. And we're going to be talking to the general manager, Paul Thompson, and also to the sous chef, Tom Citarella. Welcome, both of you, to On the Menu.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have to get back into the kitchen, so let's sort of start with you, Tom. But you can jump in, Paul, anytime you have something to add or deny.
Thank you.
What I understand, you, no matter what you want by way of dining here, you can, or snacking or eating, there's something for everybody. Could you just run through a list of the dining options at the Manor House?
Well, we do. We have the fine dining restaurant that's just received the Michelin star, which is very informal but formal at the same time. And we have endless lounge space, which is where you can just sit down and enjoy something from a burger to freshly prepared tagliatelle or risotto. And then we offer the banquet inside. So if you want weddings, conferences, buffets, that's about it really. And obviously in-room dining, we offer this as well.
Well, now the executive chef or head chef is Richard Davies, and he's on holiday, so he can't be here. But you've worked with him. Apparently he relies heavily on a team approach to the kitchens.
Yeah, very, very, very much so.
Good. So you can tell us all about this.
Well, basically, we work as the weakest member of our team is the same as us. We all work together. Everyone is involved. No one is singled out. No one is. We just all sort of work together. Like Richard is the same level as us.
Oh, see, that's really nice.
So it's
and you all share the same philosophy of food. It's modern British cuisine. So
yeah, yes, it is. It's very, very, very simplified. There's nothing that doesn't need to be there. It's very, very, very simple.
And you, so we could say that all of the restaurants have this guiding concept of innovation coupled with tradition. Is that true?
This is true, yeah. So we, as you can see by the surroundings, we're very, very traditional old
country house.
Oh, it's
gorgeous, this place. We're going to learn all about the history when we talk.
Tonight, when you come for the dinner, you'll see the modern touch. So it's cool. I think the blend is very, very. I don't mean to sound big-headed, but I think we've got the blend very well sorted out here.
Well, now tell me, you have your ingredient-driven. This is very. It is the case with almost every top-notch chef that I've interviewed in the last 5 years. But you have some sound advantages, such as your garden. Tell us about your garden.
Well, we have. What do we have up there? We got carrots, leeks,
herbs. You have an herb garden.
Herbs, yeah, herbs, apples, plums.
Oh, you have an orchard. I forgot about that. That's an old
and
orchard.
And it's fantastic, you know, to go up there and to pick the herbs fresh and to bring them down and cook is. I don't think you can beat that. I think that's fantastic, you know, just to. We've run out of mint. Quickly run up to the garden. You know, send the young lad up to the garden. I think it's fantastic.
It's been that's been probably one of our greatest achievements over the last 2 or 3 years, is to try and reinstate that. Because, of course, when this was originally in a manor house with a family living here, that was a fully working kitchen garden where the majority, if not all, of the produce that were cooked for the family living here would have come from. So there's something very special. I know it's in vogue to do it at the moment, and a lot of places are doing that, but something very special here about taking the manor house back to its past and trying to run it as it would have been run as a family estate.
That's really cool. I like that a lot. I need to ask you this. Tell us about your chickens, because the brochure said that they were named after the gods and treated as such. Not really. Well, there used to be 6. You're down to 2 now, but they're still part of the fun of this place, huh?
Yeah, it's definitely. It's all part of the fun, yeah.
You were telling me that some little children were allowed to go and get their own eggs fresh for breakfast. That's cool.
Yeah, it's one of the many, many things that we offer. Like, I was talking about the fishing as well. Like, to go and get your own food from the garden and then bring it down and the chef cook it for you, I think.
That's cool. That's great. Okay, so we're going to do a tasting menu in the fine dining room, which is called By Brook because of after the river that crosses the estate.
That's correct.
And it's the most elegant of it, although it's still accessible for fine dining. What are we going to have? We're going to do a tasting menu. Our listeners love to hear details about food. Can you pick out just a few dishes we're going to have tonight?
Yeah, I can run through the whole tasting menu.
You don't have to do the whole one, but part of it.
The hand-dived scallops. We do hand-dived scallops with a butternut squash puree, poached pear, and chorizo. Chorizo. It might sound a bit strange, but when it marries together very, very well, the sort of the sweetness and then the fresh scallop. We do John Dory fillets with langoustine.
It's a great fish, John Dory.
Yeah, fantastic. And then with garden peas. And then we do which is one of Richard's classics, the Valrhona chocolate fondant. Now, it took a long time perfecting this, which you'll see tonight, to get the, when it's cooked, to have the, it's so soft. Tried like.
That's dessert.
I think you tried about 10, 15 times, just to get it how he wanted it. And then we do this with a tonka bean ice cream.
Oh, wonderful.
Which is one of his specialities.
Oh, good. I'm looking forward to it.
But it's fantastic. Yeah, he really went to town on this one, this chocolate fondant.
Oh.
And it's one of his.
Had you worked with Chef Richard before? I know. I think we talked about that, but that wasn't entirely clear.
No, I've not worked with. This is the first time I've worked with.
Until
I came here, yeah.
And you've been here for?
For 3.5 years.
Aye, wow. So you're almost a veteran.
Yeah. And but I've heard about Richard. And I think it was a fantastic coup for the hotel to get Richard when he did come. But yeah, obviously on the sort of chef circuit, if you like, he is quite known.
Well, people who went through the kitchen at the Waterside Inn that we've covered on this trip are also, I think, in fairly strong demand. So we know you were there, and you talked about modern British cuisine as being what you do here, and the Waterside Inn is really quite different.
Yeah.
But you brought some interesting ideas from there, nevertheless?
Yeah, definitely. The Waterside Inn, for me, was just a massive learning curve. It's basically where you learn to cook. That's what I'd say I learned to cook at the Waterside Inn. Because obviously, you cook before and after, now, but I think the majority, I learned everything, every basic technique, I learned at the Waterside Inn.
Well, that's good.
I'm forever grateful to Chef Alan,
well,
Chef Michelle.
Fantastic. Well, I can't wait, but I'm going to release you to, because you're answer to go to the kitchen here and cook this all up. But I thank you for taking time to talk to us.
Oh, no problem. No problem at all.
Well, we'll see you next at dinner.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks, Tom.
Cheers.
Okay, Paul. Tom, your last name is Citarella.
Yeah.
Meaning what? Little lemon. Whatever, but it is Italian.
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit, because you were explaining about your ancestry.
Well, the name comes from Napoli, and my granddad's parents moved from Napoli to London I couldn't tell you the date, but they moved from London, and this is where I get my Italian sort of connection from.
And but you said that your grandmother was a huge influence on
you. she was a massive, like, she loves to cook, but then she used to do a lot of big events outside catering, you know, cooking for thousands of people. And when she heard that I was, you know, going into the catering industry, she was over the moon, you know. So like every sort of, you know, job that I changed and stuff, and promotion or, you know, new thing, always interested to know, you know.
Oh, I mean,
massive,
isn't it
like
great?
Helped real big influence on my career to date.
You said she died last week,
yeah.
Isn't it wonderful that she got to see your your development in this field? That's great.
Yeah, I'm I don't know, I owe a lot to my nan.
Well, we all do, our nan.
Yeah.
So anyhow, thank you so much.
No problem.
Well, there you are, listeners. Another.
And he did a nice job. This was his very first media appearance, and I just thought that was great.
Yeah, I thought so too. And dinner was fun. We got to talk to the people at the next table who were celebrating their second wedding anniversary and having a wonderful time. And everybody in the whole room seemed to be doing the same thing.
They had been married there.
Yeah, they.
A lot of these great
right.
houses.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
right.
A lot of the great country estates are making a secondary business out of weddings.
Actually,
and
I think you're getting slightly mixed up, because when we were at Clifton, having dinner, the people at the next table were also celebrating a wedding anniversary, and they'd come all the way from Canada to celebrate.
Oh, that's right. Clifton. But didn't we have two weddings at Manor House back to back?
There was a wedding going on when we got there, and there was a wedding the next day. And
they put out the photographs, the wedding photographs.
Right, right. Well, they did that at Clifton too.
Yeah.
One of the things they didn't do is they didn't put out photographs of the weather because it rained, but it was so much fun, we really didn't care. Anyway, we'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.
Bye-bye.